The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it's hard not to speak something about the shootings in Connecticut today. I have a fifth grader who went to elementary school this morning, and I was very aware that there's something like 50 million school children in the United States. It's a lot of kids, and it's not clear how many of them know what happened on Friday. Like, some of the younger kids don't really know so well. But their parents do. Most of those parents do. And I think for all those parents, it was a pretty tender time to leave their kids, bring their kids to school this morning. And there were various discussions I had with my wife about bringing our son to school and what that would be like. And then this evening, my wife met one of the teachers in the school, a teacher my son had last year, and they talked a little bit. My wife asked, well, how was it for the teachers? And they talked about that they had met, I guess, before school, and or met and talked about what would they do for the kids at the local school here, just a couple blocks away. And they decided not to do anything, or each teacher had their own choice of what to do. So I picked up my son from school this afternoon, and my antenna was up. What was that like for him today? What happened at school? What did the kids talk about? I wasn't going to ask any leading questions. So, a tender time for many people in this country. And some of us, it's more than tender. I was teaching retreat last week, and so I wasn't, so I, and I saw the news on Friday, and then Saturday afternoon I saw the news again and was kind of reading about it, and then I looked at photographs of most of the photographs were photographs of afterwards of parents coming picking up their children. And suddenly, to my surprise, I started sobbing. Something so far away. So I don't know how you guys were impacted by these shootings, but it's one of these events that opened up a wound in American society for many people. And so such a big one that the President of the United States went to give a talk. And in that capacity as a president, coming to represent a whole nation, because this, in a way, happened to the whole country, it happened to everyone. And I think that something to consider, something I consider it's important for me, is that as tragic as this event is, the fact that it touched hearts, so many hearts, in such a big way, that there was so much tenderness, so much care, so much concern, so many hearts moved by this, I think it speaks really well for the human heart. Imagine if we didn't care. Imagine if we all just shut down. Well, who cares about that? But there's a lot of caring about it. And I think that caring that we have carries the day. A year and a half ago we had this shooting in Norway, which touched me because I'm Norwegian. I was born in Norway. But what moved me the most there was not the shooting, but rather the response of the Norwegians the common response I read about in the paper was they were not going to let the shooting destroy the nation or destroy their soul, or they were going to come back with love and come back with the values of that society. And so here we have a chance as well. Our hearts are moved. And rather than be weighed down by this event, can we be buoyed by it? Can we be encouraged by it? Can it fuel the best that's in our hearts? Can we recognize what's really good in our hearts and give voice to it, or have it move us? I think would be the Buddhist response to this kind of event. I think one of the advantages of Buddhist practice is the ability to turn the mirror around and learn to sit still, or to sit with our feelings, sit with what's our impact, sit with the situation of the world, be a witness to what goes on, and not to succumb to some of the difficult emotions we have, not to succumb to being horrified or anguished, not to succumb to the burden of grief, but rather certainly to feel those things, but not to succumb to them, but rather to learn how to sit still and have them there and be able to still stay open, still move forward, and still respond from the best parts of who we are. And I think the, day after day, or month after month, year after year, of sitting in meditation is not the training in becoming calm or being blissed out, but most important is a training to stay present above all else in the midst of what's going on for us. And keep coming back to being present, but present meaning the present that allows us to be independent or free from what goes on inside of us and the world around us. And not free so that we're aloof or indifferent, but free so that we could take what comes, take our experience of life, and be changed by it for the better, and respond from the best that we have, and make a difference in the world. When 9/11 happened, it seemed to me that it was kind of a violence. I should maybe speak just in personal terms, but I felt it was sort of kind of a violence to myself if I didn't allow that event to change me, because I could see how easy it was to be horrified and upset and talk about all kinds of things in the week or weeks immediately afterwards. But I could see how that could fade away over time. And it didn't seem right to let it fade away. That didn't seem to be right given what happened. It seemed like the situation required to be changed myself. And so I allowed myself to change. I made choices in my life and turned the directions of my life in certain ways, in new ways, that I still live with those choices I made because of 9/11. And so here for this event, the bigger the impact it has on us and our hearts, the bigger impact it has on the people we know and around us, is it a time for us to look, to allow it to impact us for the better? How would we, what choices would we make differently? And because if we just continue and say, it's their problem out there, someone should fix the problem. And we just spout our opinions about how terrible things are, we're not changed. How do we change so we come forward with the best in ourselves, come forward for the better? So one of the approaches of Buddhism to many so-called problems in life, personal problems, ethical problems we've had, ways we've made, mistakes we've made, situations around us, is to stay present for them, let them register, be honest and truthful or whatever it might be, inside or outside, but not to be weighed down by anything, not to be weighed down by the past, but to look at the past and learn from it and then be forward-looking, and to see how can I do better in the future? What can I contribute in the future? And so rather than being weighed down and feel like a victim, the idea is to look forward and say, what can I do to be empowered, to feel like an agent of change, as they say, to feel a place of strength, to feel a place of the values that we carry and a willingness to act on them, as if each person's actions and each person's values count for a lot. So one of the things that struck me as this weekend, as I was reflecting on all this and living with it, was you know, this is certainly the issue of gun control. That's many people, especially the kind of people that I spend time with, you know, they immediately will voice, well, we need to have gun control. And so I don't know much about gun control. You know, I kind of think it's a great idea. I don't want any guns myself. I'm happy to live in society without any guns. But I don't know much about this issue of gun control. So I started, I did some research reading about it. And one of the surprises in reading about it was how there is so much research that's been done on gun control, and it seems like there's no conclusive decisions. I mean, if you read one study, they have a conclusion. But if you read a whole bunch of them, they contradict each other. And so the different sides of gun control, they bring forth, you know, this study or in this study, and you know, and it's complicated, the whole issue. But what struck me in reading it was a number of things. One was the polarity, how quickly these things have polarized and conflict arises, and how the same event can get radically different responses from good people. That some people say, well, we need to control guns, and I think there's good people who out there say, well, no, we have to give guns to the principals. You know, to me, I'm kind of horrified by the idea, but I think these are good people, probably, some of them. And so the Buddhist approach is not to get involved in these polarities or in these conflicts directly, unless we have to, but rather is to look for the common ground and see if there's a common ground or a higher ground for the common good of everyone. And I think there's, you know, more important than gun control is that there's people have a need for safety. And I think that the people, you know, I like to believe that everyone is concerned about safety. The people who want to have guns are looking to be safe. The people who are looking to be a society without guns are looking to be safe. And so the question is, you know, so this is something we share in common, is a desire for safety. And we look for safety in different ways. And so, but if we understand the issue is safety rather than the issue of guns, do we have a different conversation? And can we approach the problem in a different way? Maybe looking for different solutions. The question is, what helps us all to be safer? Not the question of, you know, if that's the question. And maybe there are different solutions and different approaches. Maybe, I mean, it's certainly at times guns don't make us any safer. One of the leading causes of gunshot deaths is called crimes of passion. People, family members and spouses who know each other and get angry and the gun is close by. I had a Zen teacher I know who ended up in jail because in the heat, passion of the moment, he went and pulled out a gun that he had in his garage. And didn't have any bullets in it, but he behaved in such a way that he got arrested. And he was provoked because he was held up at knife point. And so that, you know, it's a pretty powerful thing. Adrenaline runs, and so he's held up. And his response to it was to get this gun and go look for the guy. And then the police picked him up. Rather than the robber, the police picked him up. So there's, you know, the crime, you know, people do things impulsively. But are there other ways of being safe? And so there was, I don't know if it's so popular anymore now, but I know 15 years ago in the Bay Area, it was quite popular for people to take self-defense classes and to learn the skills of defending themselves without using a gun. Now, are they as effective as a gun? I don't know. But they are effective to some degree. And are there a variety of things we can do to become a safer society that answers the questions of safety without the question of guns? And if we talk about safety, as an issue, then we talk about fear. How do we relate to fear? What's our understanding of fear? What's the practice of fear? And I think this is where something like mindfulness and Buddhism, I hope, can offer help to our society, is it offers practices and understandings that helps us to look and address fear and question fear. Rather than live in fear or be pushed around by fear, to be able to turn around and actually learn to work with fear and not to give it so much authority. One of the powerful things that mindfulness does, or Buddhism in general, is to question the authority that we give to some of our emotions. The authority we give to our anger. Some people give tremendous authority. Some people give their authority over to their anger and they act on it. Some people give a lot of authority to their fear. And it's inconceivable to them that they wouldn't, because fear is so compelling. But in fact, it's not necessary to give fear any authority. It's possible to be afraid and to be able to stay, keep the authority with yourself. See the fear and be able to choose responsibly and clearly what to do. And the question of, it's an important thing to do, because fear should be questioned. The issue of safety should be questioned. What makes us really safe? Where is safety found? Is a very powerful issue that I think Buddhist practice asks us to look at and question. How as a society do we help each other feel safer? How as a society do we help each other deal with fear? How as a society do we help each other deal with anger? I think are important issues. And is that society's job to do that? Do we teach our children in school how to work with and be wise about fear and anger and grief and sadness? Or is that not the job of the schools? Do we expect the parents to do it? So do the parents need to learn about this? How do we train a society? But who's allowed to tell us to do this? Who's allowed to have that opinion that this is good for us to do? I mean, I can't tell that to people, right? I mean, I'm a Buddhist teacher. I mean, that would be, I wouldn't get very far in America as a Buddhist teacher standing on a pulpit and say, you know, let's teach mindfulness in the schools so the kids can learn to be wiser about their fear and their anger. I don't think that's going to go very far. So, you know, how does this change happen? So I don't know about society, and maybe you don't know about society in the same way, but maybe you know about your hearts. Maybe you know about how you want to live. And so for me, the question of the weekend, this week, coming out of Friday and these shootings, is if you take this event seriously, if it was important for you, then to be encouraged, maybe I shouldn't use the word inspired in the context of these kinds of tragedies, but encouraged propelled or maybe aspire to have your heart changed for the better through this. How can you make a difference in the world? What do you do with your fear? What do you do with your anger? What do you do with your love? What do you do with your care for the community and the people around you? Are there ways that you can live so that you can make a difference to the people around you? The issue of violence has been going on since the time of the Buddha, and way before that even. And there's a very powerful poem that is attributed to the Buddha, and some of the oldest texts survive from Buddhism, so it qualifies it maybe that goes back to the time of the Buddha. And why it's kind of significant is that he talks about what propelled him to his quest for awakening, for freedom. And it has to do with violence. It begins, violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water, and seeing them in conflict with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everywhere things are changing. Wanting a place of my own, I saw nothing not already taken. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. So that's quite something. There's, you know, in his world, that he saw so much conflict. Not a new thing that we feel violence and conflict. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict at the very end. So these words, his dismay and shaken and being afraid and feeling discontent, you know, speaks to someone who was deeply moved and troubled by what he saw in the world. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow's pulled out, they do not run and they do not sink. So this describes the Buddha's way he was agitated or troubled by what he saw in the world. And then in his search for something, somehow he was able to see something in his own heart. And he, as the word is here is translated as arrow. It could be translated as a barb. So something painful that's embedded in the heart. It doesn't belong there. And then he pulled it out. And when that arrow is pulled out, people don't run and they don't sink. People are not agitated and they don't succumb to what goes on. So that's what he did for himself. He discovered how to pull the arrow out. And then for 45 years, he went around India teaching and helping other people to do the same. So what is this foreign body that's lodged in people's hearts? Is it in you? If you're afraid, if you have a tendency to succumb to anger sometimes, if you have issues with addiction and desires, if you have behaviors and distress, discouragement, if you have depression, there's many issues that can be, if you pay attention carefully, you can find there's something lodged. Another language used in Buddhism, a root for it. There's a source for this irritation in the heart. There's a trouble, some trouble in the heart. And part of what we do for this mindfulness practice, meditation, is to sit still enough so we can discover what that is and pull it out. So that when we see the violence of the world, we are not then a violent person. When we live in a world of fear, we learn not to be afraid ourselves. When we see a world of greed, we're not greedy ourselves. When we see a world of anger, we're not angry ourselves. But rather, we can maybe come from the heart's generosity, the heart's capacity for love and for care. And most important, I think, one of the things I see so important for living in society is that to always be asking the question, where's the common good here? Where's the common ground? How do we live in a society where we don't look for the divisions and perpetuate the divisions, but can we look for the place where we can meet and find each other and find a way together that works for everybody? If everyone's afraid and we start there as looking for the solution, will we come to different answers than if we start with questions like gun control? So the last thing I'll say is that the fact that the President of the United States would go to Newtown, Connecticut, speaks to how a whole nation has been moved. And I would like to live in a society where we take care of each other. And so how do we best take care of each other? How do we support each other? How do we care for each other? The common good. How do we break down the walls of individualism that keeps us separate from each other? So that it's not just about me and myself and my own. I think that's one of the most important tasks of this society, if we're going to go forward into the future in a healthy way, is to learn how to overcome the arrows in the heart that keep us living me, myself, and mine, and rather live in a society where we come forward with us. And how do we live together in one heart? How do we live together in one community? How do we live together for the common good? And how can we support that and contribute to it? So I hope that in saying these words, I could say something that was meaningful for you in this context. I never really quite know what to say in these kinds of events when these things happen, but it feels like it's important to somehow speak to it. And if for some reason that what I said didn't work for you, or I'm sorry, it's a tender time for all of us. Would any of you like to speak? Anything you'd like to say at this point? Though I think that, I'd like to keep it open, but I think that if you want to speak, I have a request, and that you be careful not to come with a really strong opinion about what should happen. I think sometimes it's easy to say, come with opinions of what should happen, or an explanation of something, but sometimes it becomes more divisive than it is helpful. So is there some way of, to speak your heart, speak how you are, speak something about what you feel you ought to share? I think that would help us all feel together. It'd be nice.
About your talk, I said to a friend of mine last night, his wife is an elementary school teacher, I said, "How's your wife doing?" And he said that she told him, she said, "After this has happened, I don't think I could ever retire." So I was like, I thought that was really inspiring.
That's nice.
One of the things that really appeals to me in the idea of working with mindfulness in the schools is that children would be able to grow up more comfortable with their feelings, and that it seems to me the essence of mental health as opposed to mental illness. Mental illness is really coming up in me after this tragedy, for one thing, because of apparently this person's isolation. I don't know a lot about it yet, but it seems to me that if we could, if we could share our feelings more with each other and just set the model of it being a healthy thing to do, to carefully, sensitively, just invite exploring what we do when anger arises and fear arises, and generally just try to create more of an atmosphere of permission to seek help when there is need for help.
Yeah.
that would be good.
Yeah, speak to how do we support each other in our society. Thank you. Behind you there.
Very rare event. You might want to take a picture. My wife is a grade school principal, and when this happened, I texted her right away because I knew she wasn't going to know about it. I happened to be home and flipped on the computer and saw it on the internet. And shortly after it happened, the police came to her school to try to make sure everything was okay, because a lot of times you have these copycat type crimes that occur. And I will say that it affected her very deeply. She cried a lot because she has all sorts of young kids that she's responsible for. And I will add that I will honor Gil's request and not express any of my opinions, but I wrote the White House yesterday, and you can write the White House. There's a website you can go to, and you can express your opinions there. And so I did. Anyway, that's it.
If anyone is interested in learning more about mindfulness in the schools, we have some flyers in the back, right next to the Mahapajapati statue on the left side.
The outer hall, there's a mic over here on this side. You can go.
You know, one of the things I remember, Gil, that you said after the tragedy in Norway was that the community went to the, I think it was a young man's mother's home, and welcomed her and, you know, basically forgave her and didn't isolate her. And, you know, the parents of children who do these things are really suffering. And that was such a touching story. I love that. And it's a reminder to me that, you know, the people who do things like this, they live in a community. They're our neighbors. And how important it is to know your neighbors and to welcome them and to bring them little gifts. And, you know, it's usually the people you just can't stand who need it the most, the people who isolate themselves and who argue and are really difficult people to express understanding to, and yet they're the most important people to do this with. Mm-hmm. And they're our neighbors. We all know them.
Two things. I don't think that there's a contradiction. The research is very clear that societies such as England and Australia, who have strict gun laws, the violence is much, much lower. So I don't think there's contradictory information about that. It's not up for grabs. The other thing is, if I look at things historically, the idea of common ground intellectually sounds great. But if I look at things historically, that's not the way I see things move forward.
No, they haven't.
Certainly, it doesn't. With the civil rights that I was involved in the 60s. It wasn't with my parents trying to get a decent wage in the 20s. It wasn't just a matter of common ground. You had to really fight for what you wanted to, because there were a lot of people that didn't want to come to any common ground agreement. So I just need to make that clear.
I think that the two don't exclude each other. I think that the civil rights movements, some of the people that founded it, like Martin Luther King, was trying to reach for the common ground and reach out to the people's common goodness. But he realized in doing that, he had to be willing to put himself in harm's way. But I think that's what he was trying to speak to. But so the two don't exclude each other. I think common ground doesn't mean that you don't put your life on the line for something. you appeal to people in a different way. The great story, I've told this many times here. I was so moved when the woman told me. I was teaching a retreat, and this woman had the occasion on retreat to tell me a story when she went to the South during the civil rights times. A white woman who went from the North to the South right at the time. And she was doing she said, we had a demonstration, and we were standing on the street corner with signs and whatever, promoting civil rights. And these white guys showed up in a pickup truck, and they jumped out and started beating them up. So the next day, they went back and stood in the same place. And the same people came along and beat them up. And the next day, they went back and stood at the same place. And the same people came, she said, jumped out of their truck. And the guy was standing over her with his fist. She showed me, kind of graphic, standing over her, about to hit her again. And their eyes met. And the guy said, "What in the world are you doing?" Because it's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. And then they had a conversation. There was no more fighting. So I'd like to believe that there is a common ground we can look for, but sometimes we have to risk a lot to touch it. Yeah.
I respect what you said about opinions, and but there is a question in my mind whether those of us who are touched are the ones who were open to be touched, and if the ones who are closed to be touched, were they really touched? I don't know.
So are there people who are open and people who are closed? So are people, maybe some people cannot be touched, but the story of the pickup truck and the civil rights workers in the South, it took 3 days for the person to be touched by the humanity of the person they were hitting. So it takes a while sometimes. But people are touched in different ways, and some of the differences people have are, what one person thinks is being open and being moved in a good way, another person sees as being closed. And they see, they accuse each other of this. But I think we stay present and try to understand the other person. I think if we don't try to understand the other, I think it's lost. So how do we understand the positions of the other? We try to put ourselves in their shoes and try to understand what they're trying to do. And if we do that, then maybe we can start having a conversation with them and try to understand. And sometimes we have to be willing to be changed in the conversation.
And on the personal level, I would also like to share, because this goes back to your book, Issue at Hand. It was dealing with anger. And I kept reading your passage on anger a couple of times, and it really affected me. Looking inside myself and what is causing that hurt, in my case it was hurt, and instead of continuing to be angry with this person, I think at the personal level I generated that common ground and sat down and wrote 4 paragraphs. And not accusatory, but more open to reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And the person understood and responded positively. So one, I would like to thank you for writing that message.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And two, I think at least on the personal ground, this personal level, this common ground thing is really, it exists and it is strong.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it's... Yeah, thank you very much. I don't know if it's possible in all situations to find a common ground, but I think it's so wonderful that we begin by trying. And that's, you know, our first instinct. The Buddha defined a wise person as a person who benefits themselves, benefits others, and benefits both self and others. And I think it's such a beautiful definition of wisdom, or a wise person. I can't think of a better one. Because I think the caring for each other, for ourselves and for others, is kind of the most important things we can do. Yes.
On the subject of communication, I read some research of they took two groups of people who held opposite views but had different power levels. So they had people in Arizona and immigrants, and then some other group, I can't remember what they were. And they were assessing where did the most change and the most actual listening to each other occur. And it happened when the person who was in the position of power was listening more than they were speaking. And when the person who was in the underdog position was doing most of the talking. And that even the person who was like the immigrant understood more of the position of the person in power, even though they were the one doing most of the talking. I thought that was really interesting and worthwhile keeping in mind.
Yeah, listening to people is so important. I'm the chair of a conflict. What do you call it here? A conflict resolution group. And it helps people with conflict. And what I've seen over and over again is when people feel listened to, that takes 90% of the conflict goes away. Even if we don't solve the conflict, the tension, the problems go away when the people really are listened to. And when the people in conflict, and even the people in the conflict resolution committee, some of them haven't been so skilled. And when they don't listen to the other people, when they're not help support listening, it puts fuel on the flames. And but when you really stop and listen, the problem with listening, the problem with people is people. the problem is it takes a lot of time. And so you have to be willing to spend a lot of time listening and process. And you know, not everyone has the time. Not everyone wants to spend the time. But I hope we have time for each other. And people who meditate, hopefully at least have discovered the importance is to give time to themselves. And hopefully in the giving the time for themselves to meditate, they bring that to have more time for the world. It's my sincere hope that we all live a life, that we leave this world in a better place than we found it, in some small way, that we, at least that's our dedication. We're trying to live to be supportive and help each other in whatever way. May all beings be happy. Thank you.